All right, so the case we're talking about today is the Big M Drug Mart decision. So that was 1985 Supreme Court decision. So we're at 40 years or just past 40 years. That was in April, was it?
That's right. Okay. That's right.
So 40 years. Tell us a little bit about the case and the background to that.
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's famous for being Canada's first case under the Charter for Freedom of Religion, which might seem a bit odd because the case is called Big M Drug Mart. It's basically a drugstore against the government. And our first big freedom of religion case finds in favor of a drugstore operating on Sunday and strikes down the Lord's Day Act, which required stores to be closed on Sunday. So that's our kind of seminal religious freedom case. There's lots of good things said in the case about religious freedom, but it kind of starts off this legacy of, you know, striking down a law that has a clear Christian influence, Christian name, Lord's Day Act, and so on. So that's kind of,
So just digging into the details of that then, so the situation was, there's this drug store, Big M Drug Mart. Was it just like a mom and pop shop, or is that like a chain? Or because I'm assuming for them to take it to the Supreme Court would require a significant amount of money. And for them to decide, you know, this is what we're going to do, this is the thing we're going to stand behind, is keeping our stores open. What was the jurisdiction that was part of? Because presumably some jurisdiction decided, no, we're going to go after this.
Yeah, so the store. So the law is federal, a parliamentary law, but this happens in Alberta, right? And so the Alberta prosecutor decides to prosecute the store for being open on Sunday. It's not a mom and pop shop. It's a significant store. They obviously see a commercial interest in challenging the law under the charter and being allowed to operate on Sunday. Interestingly, in this case, there is no, for Canada's, again, first charter religious freedom case, there's no evidence of religious belief on the part of the drugstore owners, operators, employees. It has nothing to do with that. And that's actually an issue early on in the case is, can this store challenge the law based on religious freedom when they don't have any religious violation happening?
Well, and what is a business as an entity in the sense of the religious freedom anyway? Is it like, do courts rule in favor of businesses when it comes to religious freedom?
So our courts have never found that a corporation has religious freedom or enjoys that right. The courts have recognized kind of the collective communal aspects of religious freedom, the associational aspects of religious freedom. Right. But no, the corporation as such, Big M Drug Mart, does not have religious freedom, which begs the question, how do they then successfully challenge this law on the basis of religious freedom? And basically the court just says, no one can be convicted under an unconstitutional law. So they're being charged, they're being tried, they're going to be penalized for breaking the Lord's Day Act. But if the Lord's Day Act is unconstitutional, even if it's unconstitutional for violating someone else's rights, then they can't be convicted of it. So basically, because the store is the one being charged and potentially being penalized, they have standing, they have enough of a stake to raise the question, hey, is this law even constitutional?
Okay.
The challenge will be they don't have evidence of how it affects people's exercise of their religion, right? An obvious example might be, you know, if someone observes the Sabbath on Saturday, are they then unduly burdened because they also have to not work on Sunday, right? The religion compels them not to work on Saturday. The law compels them not to work or operate their store on Sunday. Maybe that would be too big a burden, but those facts aren't here. Instead, the company is going to say, this law on its face, we don't even need evidence. This law is just on its face is invalid because it's religious. It serves a religious purpose and not a valid secular or public purpose.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it would have, I mean, this is just a hypothetical, but if you had a situation where maybe it was actually one of the employees saying, I mean, I suppose you could have that today, an employee saying, you know, my religion I have to not work on Sunday. And so I'm not going to come into work on the days that my work is currently expecting me to do so. That would be more in line with like a Section 2A kind of case, right?
That's right. And there's actually there's an American case in the 60s where basically that happens. Someone is refusing to work or be available for work on Saturday. They're having a hard time getting a job. They tried to claim unemployment benefits and they're denied, saying you're not making yourself available for work on Saturday. And they challenge that policy and say, actually, I think it was a Jehovah's Witness, said that unduly burdens me because I'm not expected to make myself available for work on the Sunday, but I am on the Saturday. That's discriminatory against me. And the court strikes down that policy, the Supreme Court of the United States, on the basis of the free exercise of religion. And the U.S. famously has two religion clauses in its Bill of Rights. The first is the free exercise of religion. The other is the establishment or non-establishment of religion. That means the state can't basically officially support, endorse one religion while disadvantaging others. There's a number of these Sabbath law cases in the states, and they're on the establishment question. They find that no, a common day of rest has a legitimate public purpose. It's not a violation of the establishment clause. It's not establishing Christianity as the religion of the state. But on the other hand, in that one example, they found it unduly burdened this woman's free exercise of religion, because again, she would have to end up losing a benefit or violating her conscience by working on Saturday.
Okay. Can you explain that section 2A a little bit? I know we kind of just jumped right into it, but what's 2A talking about?
Yeah, so our constitution, our charter, does not have the same setup as the US. It just says freedom of conscience and religion. And so that's obviously very, very open to interpretation. What's it going to require to respect Canadians' freedom of religion? And in this case, the Attorney General of Alberta argues that the relevant question is the effects of the law. So Big M Drug Mart is going to have to show that someone's not able to practice their religion. Someone's being unduly burdened in practicing their religion. And Big M Drug Mart says, no, freedom of religion only requires us to show that the law has a religious purpose. Right? It doesn't necessarily even prevent anyone from living out their religion. It's just that it's...
They're trying to say it's an illegitimate law.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Just on its face. And there's some objections to that. The lower court's saying the charter doesn't give judges a mandate to strip Canada of its Christian foundations or Christian roots or Christian symbolism and all of that. But the Supreme Court is very sympathetic to this kind of the secular line of argument that there are purposes laws may not serve, including religious compulsion, right? And I think there's some truth to that. But the question is going to be, is this actually a law that's compelling the observance of religion?
Hmm. So you mentioned this is sort of the first Supreme Court ruling on this particular clause in the charter. Does this sort of set the stage for the secularism of Canada in some sense? Or has that already been happening? Or had it been happening before that point?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think this is kind of the really, really big issue, the deeper historical philosophical issue in this case is, what does it mean? So the court says to be legitimate, a law has to be secular. And what does that mean? I suppose you could find some support for that in Christian thought. Some people say the idea of the secular actually is rooted in Christianity, that the magistrate who in ancient civilizations often, religion and politics are completely fused, and the king is even a kind of religious figure. Well, to say civil government has limited purposes that are temporal, that are bound to, this life, this earth, and not things eternal. And so not compelling people, let's say, to choose a very obvious example, to confess Jesus as Lord and God. You can't compel people to believe that. You can't compel people to confess that. So there's something to that, to say, well, the law should have a secular or at least a legitimate public purpose. But in this case, it seems to go beyond that, because as the lower court, the dissent in the lower court was keen to point out, there's no requirement to attend church. There's no requirement to agree with Christianity. There's none of that. And there was actually evidence of the labor movement's support for this as just good for workers, good for families, that, when kids are off school, parents can be off school, off of work. But the court hones in on the religious history of Sabbath laws that included sometimes required church attendance, obviously not required here, and the name of the act itself. And one of the things the court says is it sends a signal to non-Christian Canadians that, the majority religion is Christianity, that's more important, and so on. And so where I think the secularism piece comes in is to say we can't even signal that Christianity is more dominant, more important than other faiths. They really emphasize the kind of multicultural aspect of Canada, which in some ways, I guess, becomes a little bit dismissive of the way that Christianity actually shapes our laws and institutions.
Right. And I was just going to ask, actually, in relation to that, like, where did the Lord's Day Act come from originally? Because obviously that's, you know, it sounds like it was introduced by somebody who believed in the Lord's Day. So what's the history of that? Was that there from Confederation, or?
It's a fairly complicated history, and I'll try to be really brief about it. So these laws go back in England, many centuries, but the court kind of picks up. I mean, you can actually go back all the way to, I think, the Edict of Constantine, where he proclaims the Day of the Sun as a day of rest and kind of fuses pagan and Christian elements. The Day of the Sun, I guess, was an important pagan day as well, but he can kind of please both the pagans and the Christians by saying, let everyone rest from their trade on that day. So it goes way, way back. But the court in this case picks up, fast forward 1,200 years from Constantine to Queen Elizabeth II, and the first. And in England, certain Sabbath observance laws were really about religious uniformity, right? So they included, you're going to church, you're going to this church is following this liturgy. There were lots of things attached to some of these laws that were really about pushing religious uniformity. But later versions of those laws, even under the Puritans, they were more about what you could or could not do on a Sunday in terms of entertainment and kind of public activities. And some version of that has kind of continued down through English history. So when you transfer this to Canada, the initial provinces copied some of these laws, but then some of those were earlier struck down as basically incurring on something that's federal jurisdiction. And that confuses this case as well. So for, you know, ordinary labor and employment law, that fits with provinces, but it's found that this does have to do with religion. It does have to do with public morality, and that's more federal law. Something you end up is in the very early 20th century, a movement for a federal day of rest law. And that's supported by the labor movement and certain Christian groups. Again, for in some ways, yes, religious motivations, that it would be healthy for society to have a common day of rest. It makes it easy for everyone to attend church. You hope that many people will, but again, not required. So 1906 is when the Federal Lord's Day Act is enacted in Canada.
Okay. So in terms of where that decision took us, so obviously you've already outlined the fact that the court was considering this in the context of a multicultural nation. In the decades that followed that, did we see a change in behavior of Canadians as a result of that overthrowing that law, or was some of that change already happening? I guess I ask this in the context of, you know, when we're talking about a secular nation or how Canada defines itself as a secular nation now, moral law now becomes defined essentially by the law of the land rather than a higher moral authority, right? And I think we're seeing a little bit of that tussle here between, okay, if some people in the country don't believe there's a higher moral power, how do we rule this a nation like this? So anyway, I asked multiple questions in there, but yeah. Was there a shift, I guess, after that court case?
So a shift in behavior, yes. I mean, so one thing is the Lord's Day Act had certain exceptions where if provinces explicitly allowed you to do something, then basically Parliament said, then it's okay, you can do it. So there was some degree of work and commercial activity that was permitted depending on the province. You do see after this case, the Ontario had a day of rest legislation that the next year the Supreme Court upheld, saying this is more clearly secular. The kind of Christian language wasn't present in
that law. So that just came down to like the title of the law?
Basically, yeah. Okay. Yeah, the title. And to some extent, they look into the debates a little bit and the more explicit kind of Christian groups pushing for it for public morality reasons isn't there. So they say a very similar law is legitimate. The very next year, the court says that.
And that's primarily because of its public good, the labor laws and things like that.
Right.
It gives people freedom to go do whatever they want on that day.
Right, right.
Rather than that, it's a religious observance.
That's right. Just kind of the common good value of a common day of rest. But I mean, we obviously do see a shift in terms of just, I think the law in that way is a teacher. The fact that this the Lords of the Act is struck down. There's, in some cases, weaker provincial laws in its place. But it does start a trend to basically say it's up to everyone to determine whether they want a day of rest and whether that's something that's important to them. It's not a shared part of our culture, our nation. There's actually a line in this case where Chief Justice Dixon basically says the law is kind of rooted in an age where it was kind of assumed that society had a common duty to a common deity. And that's just not the case anymore, despite the preamble to the charter, mm-hmm. Which I don't think the preamble to the charter, which mentions the supremacy of God, would directly decide any case. But it's just interesting that the court seems to say we don't, or imply that we don't have a kind of common societal duty to a deity. The court's kind of agnostic about who that deity would be. But that's pretty striking as well.
Did this start a pattern of challenging law within Canada that had a religious undertone to it? Like, let's say, even the right to life, I think, right? Some of those that legislation or laws relating to, or charter challenges, whatever you want to call it, relating to abortion and even euthanasia more recently, like these things have all come out of, to some degree, an understanding that because Canada was founded on Christian principles, those things no longer stand on their own. And so we have to ask, almost question everything in the secular context.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's you're going to see the court avoid saying explicitly that in future cases, that kind of Christian morality or morality rooted in Christianity is illegitimate and has no place in the public square. The court in some ways is actually going to explicitly repudiate that view and say, no, Christians and other religious people are allowed to be informed by their beliefs when voting on legislation and so on. But what we have seen is sometimes the court basically just avoids the issue. So when it comes to the euthanasia case, for example, in 1993, the court upholds Canada's euthanasia law. They find the inviolability of life to be an important principle underlying the law. That's rooted in Christianity. They don't really discuss that point, that this is rooted in Christianity. It's just kind of taken for granted. Our law has certain foundational principles, foundational beliefs, such as the dignity of the person and the inviolability of life. And then in Carter, they just largely just sidestep that. And they kind of think, the court says, this law is really about protecting vulnerable people from being unduly pressured to end their lives. And they kind of even though this law goes back to basically as long as we've had a criminal code and beyond that, we've had this, you cannot consent to your own death. And the court kind of says that's really about protecting autonomy. And so they just reinterpret the purpose of the law, right, to kind of get around some of these foundational principles like the inviolability of life, which is, of course, rooted in Christianity. So that's kind of the way you're seeing the court, again, without saying, we couldn't possibly allow this to be informed by Christianity. They're finding ways around it. Another really good example of this is the, going back earlier than the Carter case, in 2002, the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Chamberlain versus Surrey School District. And that case involved a school board voting against including very pro-LGBT books for kids, kids' books showing two dad families, etc. They voted against adding those to the school. And the lower court judge said, BC public schools, as the legislation said, have to be conducted based on secular principles. And the fact that there was evidence that some of the school board members were religious and that their religious beliefs informed their vote on the LGBT books means this is illegitimate. It has no place. Their religious beliefs have no place in that vote. The BC Court of Appeal says, quite strongly corrects the trial judge and says the implication of that is religious people don't have a place on school boards, or they are supposed to leave their beliefs at the door. Right. That's not right. So this goes to the Supreme Court. You've got diametrically opposed lower court judgments, and the Supreme Court, I suppose, maybe trying to split the middle, but I think largely failing to, sides with the trial judge in the result, saying you should have approved these books, affirms what the Court of Appeal says in somewhat softer language about, we do have to accept religious beliefs inform people's views in the public square, and we can't filter those out. But then the court says the problem here wasn't that your religious views were, you know, in the back of your mind or informing your vote on these books. The problem is that you didn't also and equally consider the views of LGBT people and alternative families. So you use what the court calls an exclusionary philosophy to inform your vote. So it's kind of like, it's okay that you're a Christian, your Christian beliefs inform this, as long as you're giving the same weight to the concerns of the other side. And that's a bit of a specious way of kind of saying the what's considered the more tolerant, the more open-minded, the more inclusionary view will win out. And the court can say that without saying that that Christian views don't have a place, and they explicitly affirm that they, you know, they do have a place in the public square. So you're finding the court, again, there's language we can use when it comes to, you know, arguing religious freedom cases, to say that the religious principles, beliefs of Canadians form the foundation for our most basic laws, our mm-hmm. criminal law, even for our constitutional rights, and to affirm that. And basically to try to keep our courts from some of this kind of slippery reasoning that says we're not going to dismiss religion entirely, but we're also going to kind of get around it by framing laws as having to serve certain other purposes, or serve diversity, serve inclusion, that kind of thing.
So what I'm hearing from what you're saying is Canada in some way has established differently than the Americans, which look at sort of this separation of church and state much more like rigidly, I think, that the Canadian court has basically said, you know, we not only do we tolerate religion in the public sphere, but we actually think people ought to bring their religious concerns and beliefs with them into their job and into their, to a certain extent, into a court case like that, right? That you're saying, they're basically saying we don't, we're not expecting people to leave their religion at the door. But it seems to me that, you know, I mean, you mentioned Jehovah's Witnesses. For some reason, Jehovah's Witnesses show up in a lot of religious That's right. freedom cases. But the Supreme Court has been ruling in favor of religious freedom sort of for the little guy, it seems like, right? And that's the context in which it's permissible, seemingly, in the public eye right now, if it's a minority concern. It's like, okay, we've got these, you know, minority group, this minority religious belief. How do we protect that in law? But then it seems like, but then I think in the case of Trinity Western, which was, you know, the same Supreme Court, didn't consider sort of this minority religious consideration when it was up against a concern about sexuality, right? That was kind of the tussle between different sections of the charter, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's interesting. Trinity Western, the Lord's Day Act was previously upheld. Trinity Western, the court went a different way than the previous Trinity Western case. Same with euthanasia. Our Supreme Court decisions seem to have a shelf life of 10 to 20 years, but that's a separate question, separate issue. It's true. Canada doesn't have the same history of kind of this strict separationism. We do have built into our original constitution, you know, support for religious schools. Like we still fund Catholic schools in Ontario today, but the court already hints in Big Drug Mart that's somewhat of an anomaly. That's kind of a, you know, a historical accident, exactly. Yeah. But that it doesn't really fit the charter. It's been interesting to see as well that the United States Supreme Court in the 60s and 70s, so, you know, leading up to this case, of course, in 1985, and still in the 80s, they had very much a kind of strict separation approach, such that even money, federal money going to religious organizations that were engaged in, you know, common good type work, so not religious indoctrination, was not allowed, right? So imagine even a program to like build playgrounds open to the community. Well, if a religious school built a playground that would, you know, outside of school hours, be open to the religious community, could they have funding, get any public funding for that? For a while, the law in the states was no, and religious symbolism on public buildings, no, and that kind of thing. The Supreme Court in the United States has since softened very much on that, to say the point of the Establishment Clause is not that there can be no cooperation with religion or no support for religion. It's more of it's an even-handedness. There's no official state religion that gets, you know, benefits to the exclusion of others. But as for your point about, you know, this concern with the minority, I think that's right. And in a way that makes sense. I mean, when we talk about a constitutional bill of rights or charter of rights, the concern is often said to be for those whose rights wouldn't be defended by the majority. If you're in the majority, presumably parliament legislatures, which are majoritarian institutions, are not going to too quickly violate your rights because that would be politically that, right. Yeah. But the minority might get overlooked or possibly even, you know, deliberately persecuted by the majority. And so the idea is unelected judges are not subject to this kind of majoritarian pressure. They can make sure that we're looking out for the minority. So there's some sense to that. But again, I think what you're seeing here is that kind of sentiment go too far, because there isn't a requirement for religious observance. The Ontario law actually has, which the court does later uphold, does have exceptions kind of built in. So if you do observe Saturday as your Sabbath, then you're allowed to work on Sunday. There's making sure that there's not disadvantage to religious minorities in that way. But the concern here seems to be the message, right? That it the court says it sends a discriminatory message. It tells people who aren't part of the Christian majority that they're somehow lesser. And so there's this kind of almost, you know, critical theory-esque aspect to this, that it's there's this chafing at the idea of Christianity as really being the majority religion, and publicly so. I think is largely shaping the court's judgment here.
Is it fair to say that this is kind of the moment in which Canadian culture shifted from a common understanding that there was a superior, that there was an established moral structure outside of us, and it became more of a majority rule type of, you know, the courts or the legislatures are making decisions now based on simply what the majority's preference is to some degree?
Yeah, this is getting at something interesting as well. I mean, the court does seem somewhat dismissive, again, of the Lord's Day Act, because it's like, well, we have this because majority religion is Christianity, even more so in 1906 than today. You know, it's just kind of, and that's not good enough. But the court is actually going to, in its reasoning, point to universal rights. So it's going to say that the charter is kind of the culmination of a universal rights movement, the idea that everyone has inherent dignity and inherent rights, and that these are universal. They're not just relative to the majority of a given country and the popular will.
Saying they're biblical concepts,
right? They're above and beyond that. That's right. So that kind of universalism, and of, you know, if we have rights in one place, people have them everywhere because of who they are. There's that kind of universalist aspect to this case that's clear. What I find very interesting is that's kind of the cutoff point. So they say we have religious freedom, we got respect for people's dignity. Dignity includes not compelling people to confess or believe something. I agree with all of that. And then the court's basically extending that to say respect for people's dignity also, in a sense, means not sending this message of you're the other, you're in the minority. Canada's official, you know, Canada's law favors Christianity. That has a implicit discriminatory message. Mm-hmm. They're really, really extending dignity to include, to cover all of that. But the question is, if we do have all these rights, we do have religious freedom, we do have a belief in inherent dignity, where does that all come from? Right? It doesn't come from the Lord's Day Act per se, but the Lord's Day Act is rooted in a way the same belief system that all those other things are rooted in, right? So I wouldn't want to stretch it too far and say, you know, by striking down the Lord's Day Act, they're, you know, they're cutting off the branch they're sitting on, that kind of thing. I suppose you can make some legitimate arguments against the Lord's Day Act to the extent it might disadvantage certain people, not having, again, kind of a balance with people who observe Saturday as a Sabbath, that kind of thing. But it does, it does kind of raise the question. If a law cannot be based on, in this case, the court's kind of saying explicitly Christian teaching, and they tie that line more directly. So there's a line here where the court says, the law, the Lord's Day Act, takes religious values rooted in Christian morality and using the force of the state translates them into a positive law binding on believers and non-believers alike, right? So it takes religious values rooted in Christian morality, translates them into law binding on everyone. Well, first of all, laws are always binding on everyone, so that's not weird. It's basically saying taking principles rooted in Christian morality and making law out of them, that's problematic. The danger of that is that's true of basically all of our laws. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe what makes this law unique is, okay, shopping in itself, working in itself, these are not bad things, right? So ordinarily think of if the law on pornography or prostitution or euthanasia or abortion is informed by Christian morality, that shouldn't disqualify the law. Although reading this quote in isolation, it would, because you're applying religious values to positive law, which applies to everyone. That's the danger of this reasoning, is it goes way too far and basically negates all laws you were hinting at earlier with
that. Yeah. And I guess I think that's my point in asking the question is, this case is bigger than it seems, because not because of the specific issue of the Lord's Day Act and its implications, but because of the fundamental foundation shift, I think, that happened. And I think that quote that you're pointing out is indicative of that, right? And the way that society, to some degree, not that that was the moment at which that shift happened, it was also a result of already a societal shift, but that sort of liberalism and other things had come in to the point that this sort of John Stuart Mill idea, right, the do the least harm kind of principle, has become the almost foundation morality of our secular society now.
That's right. There's an attempt to replace, you know, if law can't be rooted in Christian morality, what's it going to be rooted in? Yeah. That you get these supposedly neutral concepts of harm or autonomy, which, as we quickly find out, are not neutral. They're coded moral language. What is considered harmful? What is, or even something like dignity? What does that mean? What is it based on? What is incompatible with human dignity? These are big questions, and they're going to, you know, kind of presuppose beliefs about the nature and purpose and destiny of human beings.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.